Welcome to the podcast, Claim Your Excellent Life, with your host, Suzanne Kellner-Zink, where she helps professional women learn how to be happy. Suzanne will teach you how to do this through building high self-esteem, relaxation and calm, and good, healthy relationships. Tune in every week as Suzanne shares effective strategies to help you claim your excellent life with happiness techniques, self-esteem building exercises, relationship tips, and relaxation information. Make sure to head over to dawningvisions.com to subscribe to the newsletter to receive your keys to happiness, as well as other useful free gifts for you.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Claim Your Excellent Life. And we have a very special interviewee today, John Gray, who is known very well for his books that he's done through the years, but most especially, Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus. And I would like you to welcome John Gray. Hello, John. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. How are you doing today?
Well, I'm doing very well, thanks. It's a pleasure to talk with you. It's fun to meet you at my presentation at Harvard. That was really a wonderful day.
Yes, it was indeed. We learned all sorts of very interesting things through you, and I'd like to first start out with the fact that you came into your career before you even became a psychologist and an author. You were actually a monk. So I'd like to know how you just, first of all, what age you were at when you decided to become a monk, how long you were a monk, and what you learned as a result of being a monk, and why you left that particular scene of being a monk.
Well, it's very interesting. You know, Men Are From Mars has had a huge impact in the world, and often people have a huge impact when they have a unique perspective from the pack. So there's this whole university crowd, and they're all studying psychology, and they're all studying marriage and relationships, and they have these ideas that men and women should be the same. And if we were all just the same, then we could get along better. And here I came along in the early 80s and said, you know what, actually we get along much better when we recognize differences, and we can be equal without having to be the same. And I was really the only voice then doing that, one of the only voices, and continue to be one of the leading voices in this big argument that keeps going on that seems silly to me, which is, are we different? Are we just culture to be different? And of course, culture is there to support our uniqueness and our authenticity, and culture can enhance who we are or suppress who we are. And to say that men and women are the same is to suppress who we are, as opposed to embrace those differences as they show up, and there are some big differences. So part of my background as a monk actually gave me that distinction, because here I was, 19 years old. The Beatles had gone off to be with the Maharishi in India. I was a Beatle fan, and everybody was getting high on drugs, or you could get high on meditation. So I thought, okay, I'm going to get high on meditation, and went to hang out with the Maharishi, hoping to see the Beatles as well, but they had just left.
Oh, man.
I really liked the Maharishi, so I wanted to be like him. And he was a monk, and I followed him. I lived with him for 9 years. I became a master of meditation. I used to spend 15, 16 hours of meditation a day in my last 3 years of monkhood. And what it gave me, and I'm a big fan of meditation, I don't teach meditation anymore because so many other people teach it, and very few people teach Mars, Venus, so I focus on that. But meditation helped me find my authentic self. It allowed me to find the part of me that is not just conditioned self, but behind that is the witness, the authentic self that comes into this world that gets programmed by our family, by conditioning, by circumstances. And because I was a witness to that, I was able to see all that as quite illusory and not really me. And I was able to find my authentic self. So I found by the age 29, 9 years of being with the Maharishi, complete, you know, fulfillment in myself. I can be with myself. I've never felt lonely. I don't experience that. I experience tremendous love. But it's not like I don't get upset about things. I'm not some perfect person. But what I was able to find is a sense of fulfillment within myself. So when I started having relationships with women, I wasn't bent out of shape when they were not very loving or not supportive or when they weren't building up my ego or whatever. And I was able to see that, wow, they're having a completely different perspective of the world than me, and was able to validate that. I didn't judge it as wrong, because when you don't judge yourself as bad or inadequate, you can't judge others. So I didn't have that judgmentalness. And so as a marriage counselor, which I became after being a monk for 9 years, I'd gone back to study psychology at age 28 because my younger brother was bipolar, and I was trying to find a solution for him. Meditation and yoga, this didn't help him. Maybe helped a little bit. And so I wanted to study all the new psychology that was coming out in the early 70s. It was S training was one of the things, Gestalt training was another, hypnosis, NLP was fantastic, studying NLP, studying all these things, trying to help my brother. I wasn't able to help him, eventually committed suicide, but I did realize in that process that I had a talent for counseling. So then I became this marriage counselor from a non-judgmental point of view, and not really, my mind was not enmeshed in this limited thinking that was going on at the universities at that time. And keep in mind, when I say limited thinking, there's brilliance and that goes on in the universities, but there is this blind spot when it comes to gender differences. And I did not have that blind spot and began developing the ideas of Men from Mars, which is looking at the differences between men and women in a non-judgmental way. And that's how we can come forth with better understanding, and created a lot of simple examples for that people could relate to improve their relationships. And it just caught on like wildfire all around the world.
That was a shock to you, wasn't it?
I don't know if it was a shock. It was a great surprise, a happy surprise. You know, I never considered myself an author. I'd been a teacher, and for 9 years teaching the ideas in Men Are From Mars before it came out as a book. And everybody kept saying, you have to write this book, you have to write this book. And finally, when I got encouraged to do it, I did think it should be a bestseller. But this is back in the early 90s. And back then, you could be a bestseller with 50,000 books. And it was extremely rare to sell 1 million books. Right. And I remember when my publisher said to me that, how many books do you want to sell? And inside, I heard this little voice, and it said 10 million. And I certainly didn't say it because they would have thought I was crazy. And I have sold nearly 10 million hardbacks of the book. And, of course, I've gone on to over 50 million books around the world. So it was beyond my expectations. You just can't imagine what that would be. I mean, I certainly didn't imagine it. For 6 years, every Sunday, I was number one on the New York Times list. You sort of get used to that. I remember when it went off the list, I was a bit depressed. And my agent said to me, well, John, do you expect to be on forever? And I said, well, when you're on for 6 years straight, you got to think you're going to live there. And you got to create room for other people. And pretty much anybody who's interested in relationship books has read the book. So, John, you run out of people after a while.
But how many languages were you actually published in? Because you had a lot of languages, a lot of countries, right? How many?
It's definitely 50 languages or over. Yeah, it's 50 languages and lots more countries, of course, but 50 languages.
So John, this has been kind of extraordinary. I wanted to ask you, because you said something at Harvard about, you know, your brother had asked you for some help, right? And that's why you went for your PhD. He actually asked you, right?
Oh, yeah, he asked. He came to me and asked for help. I was sitting there. I'd done 7 days of a meditation retreat in the garage of a garage apartment of somebody's house. I was just hiding out, visiting home, but I needed 7 days. I would start every year with a water fast for 7 days and just meditate the whole time and very little sleep. And I get very, very high. And this particular one, it was a peak experience for me around 28 years old. And I was hearing angels singing the whole time. It was just like being at an angel concert. It was so beautiful. Because it's what the early composers of classical music, they would often say they would hear the music of the spheres. So it wasn't any, you know, that's what I was doing, is hearing the music of the spheres. And writing it down, I was writing down, sounds like this music, sounds like that music. And then I just enjoyed it, being in this altered state. And really felt, then I started having visions and felt like it was time, you know, I was not attached to this world at all. I was just so happy in the non-physical realm. And then he came and found me and said, please help me. And then had a episode. And so
what kind of episode did he have?
He just, his mind started speeding up. He couldn't make coherent sense, and he started getting...
So was he manic, would you say, or hypomanic?
Yeah, he became manic. He became manic and somewhat violent.
Can you explain to our audience what mania is versus hypomania? Because I think a lot of people get that really confused.
Well, first of all, I'm not familiar with hypomania. What do you mean by that?
Hypomania is a level of lack of judgment before they get psychotic, which is really what the mania is all about.
Yeah, I think he was in the version of just before he became psychotic, but it was hypomania, thinking, you know, the way I interpret it, and I have a beautiful way of interpreting it. First, I see bipolar as a genius brain that's not getting enough nutrition or doesn't get enough support to be genius. And what he felt when he would go into his manic states is that the whole world was a conspiracy to awaken him to his divine purpose, and that he was here to save the world, and everybody, there was a conspiracy of people, and he didn't know who the people were who were here to wake him up, and there were other people here that would put him to sleep and mislead him. And the funny thing about it is I simply have that belief on another level, which is that we're all here in this world to fulfill a divine purpose and to make a difference. And people are all here to push our buttons, so to speak, to help us overcome our challenges to become the people we are to be. And he just wasn't grounded. See, he didn't have the spiritual practice to ground himself. So when his mind would go into these non-physical realms and understand that we are spiritual beings in a physical body, he wasn't able to make the rational link between the two. So a lot of times you go to the mental hospitals, and that's part of why I left being a monk to study psychology, is I had to put him in a mental hospital, which wasn't a very nice place when I couldn't help him. I tried and tried everything. I intuitively worked with him and was not able to succeed at it. And again, I didn't have the tools I have now with NLP and hypnosis and therapy and all that, which I think could have helped tremendously along with good nutritional support. And that's, of course, my focus has been the last 10 years providing people with understanding of the nutrition for the brain. And what happens to the brain is when we don't have the right nutrition or we expose ourselves to toxicity, it actually can cause, for different types of people, different symptoms. For the majority of people, it turns into a form of ADHD. And for certain genius people, it turns into bipolar. You know, many of your great geniuses in the past have the symptoms of bipolar, which is they rise up and they feel like they have a divine mission or they can have some divine experience, and that then uses up a lot of minerals and then they crash. Then the brain can't sustain that ability to make those brain chemicals to ground themselves in kind of a practical reality. So,
and then they get depressed.
It's the feeling of bipolars. You feel like extreme optimism at one point, which is, I can do anything, and this is, I'll do this, and I'll do this. He would go through all these inventions and ideas that he could do, and there was just no practical reality of how you fulfill that or that people would accept that and so forth. And then what happens when you have these grandiose ideas, I can do it all, and you feel fantastic, and you're hyper, and you're up there, that's mania. Then when things don't happen, you become so extremely frustrated. It's just like most bipolar people, a lot of them happens around 20 years old, and they're like in college, and often they've done some drugs that help activate it, but they're feeling like, I can't understand this. I should be able to figure this out. And they have these unrealistic expectations of perfection on others and themselves. And
which makes it impossible. Let me break in here, John, because, you know, I have a history of that, actually. I was diagnosed as a bipolar 2. This is when I was like 28, 29 years old, actually. And it's interesting because in the psych model, they don't look at nutrition at all. They really don't. They just want to put you on, in my case, I was put on a huge amount of lithium. I was so depressed, I couldn't even put together a meal going to one of the biggest, largest supermarkets here. And this is something I do easily, cooking, okay? And I couldn't do anything. I was so depressed on all the medication they threw me on. And I was able to get healed through Tad James, one of my trainers. And I don't have that illness anymore. It's all gone because of NLP. It was a very simple process that I'd been doing with my clients for really, better part of a year. I just didn't know what emotions I needed to clear. And once they were cleared, no more psychiatry, no more medication was necessary. And it's been that way since 2005.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. Claim Your Excellent Life with your host, Suzanne Kellner-Zink, where she helps professional women learn how to be happy. Suzanne teaches you how to do this through building high self-esteem, relaxation and calm, and good, healthy relationships. Tune in every week as Suzanne shares effective strategies to help you claim your excellent life with happiness techniques, self-esteem building exercises, relationship tips, and relaxation information. Make sure to head over to dawningvisions.com to subscribe to the newsletter to receive your keys to happiness, as well as other useful free gifts for you.